are in La Jolla with Sean Carroll from Caltech, who's a theoretical physicist, cosmologist, and author of a new book called From Eternity to Here. Welcome.
Thank you.
And you also did a panel on the Arrow of Time at the American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting, which is in San Diego at this point. Okay. And you've also got a cover of Discover magazine. Did you write this cover line, The New Rules of Time Travel?
I wrote lines very similar to that, so they adapted mine.
Okay, so this is an extract from the book, part
That's
of
right.
it. Okay. I was talking to Martin Rees yesterday, the president of the Royal Society, and we ventured over some of this terrain in the sense that, as you would expect with Martin, who works in these areas. We talked about entropy, and we talked about Fred Hoyle, the iconoclastic Fred Hoyle, and the Big Bang Theory, and so on and so forth. This is a nice transition, but you have a different take on the whole notion of time having started from the Big Bang, which is merely one story of time's arrow that physicists would offer. So perhaps the best thing is if you situate this whole conversation to begin with by telling me the basic thrust of the book.
Sure. We have the arrow of time is the single most sort of blatant feature about time in our universe. The fact that the past is obviously different from the future. It's so different that we can almost not conceptualize it not being that way. You know, we try to invent alternative models where there is no arrow of time and people get very nervous. So you can remember yesterday, you can't remember tomorrow. You can turn eggs into omelets, but not omelets into eggs, etc. And we understand about halfway how that works. We understand very well sort of the way it plays out on a day-to-day basis based on entropy and the ideas of Ludwig Boltzmann and his friends and the second law of thermodynamics saying that entropy is increasing as a function of time. But Boltzmann didn't quite finish the project of explaining why that applies to our real world. The missing piece was something that has been dubbed the past hypothesis. Boltzmann's really good at telling us, given the universe today, why we have an arrow of time toward the future. He's very bad at explaining the past. You can't just use his ideas and explain why the entropy of the universe was lower yesterday, even though you can explain why it was higher, why it will be higher tomorrow. And that missing piece is going to be filled in by cosmology, by some theory of the Big Bang, why the entropy of the universe started so incredibly low. And so my book is, number one, trying to tell that story, trying to explain that cosmologists need to keep in mind this duty of theirs to explain the arrow of time by explaining why the early universe had a low entropy, and then also explore some of the possible theories that we could have, some of the models of the early universe that would make that true.
Okay, so the received wisdom here, by which I mean Wikipedia, of course.
Right. I quote Wikipedia on the first page of my
absolutely,
book.
Absolutely, and it says here that yes. you and Jennifer Chen posit that the Big Bang is not a unique occurrence as a result of all matter and energy in the universe originating from a singularity at the beginning of time, but rather one of many cosmic inflation events resulting from quantum fluctuations of vacuum energy in a cold de Sitter space. As I sit in this space, could you explain some of that?
Well, the observed fact is that the early universe seems to be very delicately tuned, very unusual, very low entropy, very highly organized. So there's, roughly speaking, two choices. Number one, you say that that is it. You sort of accept that as a brute fact about the universe. We don't explain it. We just observe it and move on. Or number two, you could try to say, well, things like that arise dynamically. It's sort of inevitable that if you wait long enough, you will get something like our Big Bang with something like the aftermath of it. And if that's true, I like the second way of thinking better. It seems more explanatory and more scientific to me. So if that's true, then how are you going to make that happen? Maybe by putting the Big Bang in a bigger context, by saying that our universe is not all there is, the observable part of our universe. The whole shebang is not at all smooth over very large scales. We just observe a relatively tiny part of the universe, which is smooth. But the Big Bang was not the beginning. It came out of something else. We are part of a much larger multiverse where things like Big Bangs happen all the time. And in fact, the observation that our Big Bang is special and low entropy is just a reflection of the larger universe, which has a high entropy, trying to create more and more entropy by creating more and more universes. So we're suggesting that there is no way for the universe to be static, to be quiescent, to just be sitting there. The reason why we see the arrow of time, the reason why we see flow and change in our universe, is because the universe can always change. There's no stationary point where it can just sit at. And the way that it changes is by bubbling off new universes, by having a little region of space pinch off, go its own way, disconnect from the rest of space and time, and have a big bang, you know, grow and heat up and look like what the universe that we see around us.
Again, I was talking to Martin Rees about this yesterday, about the whole notion of multiverses. Mm-hmm. And it's a tricky thing to get your head around, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. No one's going to deny that.
What's the history of that idea? Could you just do us a quick one?
Well, actually, there's a fascinating bit of history that even very few working cosmologists know until they read my book, which is that, as far as I can tell, the first modern scientific invocation of the idea of a multiverse was done by Ludwig Boltzmann in the 1890s. So this is before we had relativity, before we had the Big Bang, before we had quantum mechanics. Boltzmann was trying to understand the arrow of time. So he had to understand why the past, why the early universe, had a low entropy, was so special. And of course, he's working in a context where it's just Newtonian mechanics. Space and time are absolute. There's no expansion or contraction of the universe. So to him, a natural state of the universe was a universe full of gas and dust in thermal equilibrium. Same temperature everywhere, absolutely smooth throughout an infinitely big space, lasting forever in time, both to the future and the past. That's what he would have thought would be a natural universe. The problem is, you can't live there. There's an anthropic principle that comes in, because in thermal equilibrium, nothing ever happens. You know, we have a happy life here on Earth because the sun is a very, very different temperature than the sky around it. We are very, very far from thermal equilibrium, so that allows us to process information and metabolize and so forth. So what Boltzmann said is, okay, maybe most of the time the universe is smooth and nothing happens, but there are random fluctuations because you have infinitely long to wait. Occasionally these gas molecules floating around in empty space will come together to form a galaxy. It would take a long time. It seems very unlikely for that to happen, but you have infinitely long to wait. So Boltzmann's picture is that almost all the universe is smooth and featureless, but every now and then you get a fluctuation into something very, very low entropy, and then it bounces back and in the form of a galaxy with stars and planets and people. And so we are in the aftermath of one of those random fluctuations. So you have this pocket of interesting low entropy change and dynamism surrounded by static thermal equilibrium, nothing going on. And that's a multiverse. The basic idea of a multiverse is that the universe we see around us is highly non-representative of the true whole picture out there. So the modern version of it is that you have an expanding space-time. Our universe came from a Big Bang, but Big Bangs happen every now and again. It's not just the universe we see around us. The Big Bang was not the beginning. The universe does not stretch on the same for all of eternity. There are pockets. There are pockets where the universe looks one way over here, another way over there, and we probably are never going to be able to directly observe these pockets. But the existence of this ensemble of different universes has an important effect on trying to understand what we can explain and what we cannot explain about our local universe. You know, Kepler used to think that the most important thing to explain was the number of planets, right? But now we know the number of planets is not that interesting. Different stars have different solar systems with different numbers of planets. That's just an accident of history. So in thinking about the multiverse, we're trying to decide what features of the universe we observe are absolute, fixed, and need explanation, and which ones are just environmental accidents.
So it's rather a curious story. I mean, you know this. Again, I was talking to Martin about this. This series of demotions that we've gone through. Yeah, absolutely. You're not the center of the universe. No, it's not the only planet with sun. No. It behooves us to have a certain amount of cosmic modesty about these things. However, there is this other angle, which is that if you can think this stuff through, then that's pretty special, isn't it?
No, absolutely. I mean, my attitude is, you know, I was talking to on NPR the other day, and they said, you cosmologists, you only understand 4% of the universe, right? You know, 23% is dark matter, 73% is dark energy. Only 4% is the stuff we actually understand. Isn't that sort of embarrassing? And I'm like, we understand 4% of the universe. That's kind of amazing. That's a wonderful accomplishment. We can stretch our brains back to 1 second after the Big Bang, not just using theory, but using data. We have data about what was going on 1 second after the Big Bang, and here we are 14 billion years later. And we're trying to extend that knowledge even before the Big Bang into the infinitely far future. So it's a wonderful reflection of the fact that the universe is law-like. You know, the universe obeys patterns and rules, that we can use our observations in our very, very short cosmic lifetimes to extend our understanding way beyond our local environment.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned, a little historical note here, you mentioned Ludwig Boltzmann. One of the things that I often say in conversations with scientists and is to sort of say that the history of some of these subjects is really interesting, really
Absolutely,
gripping,
yeah.
And the characters are really interesting as well. And people say, well, no, it's, science is an edifice, we don't worry about the individual blips of characters and people. But, you know, in Boltzmann's case, as you well know, in the middle of a depression on the 5th of September 1906, he hangs himself.
That's right, yes.
And he's now buried in the Viennese.
On vacation with his family.
Plainly had been having, one doesn't know cause and effect here, but had been having this debate with Mach and other people and so on. Nobody was listening to his ideas very much at that time. You have to wonder whether wrestling with these kind of enormous concepts can get on your nerves a little bit.
Absolutely. And I talk a little bit about that in the book, but I didn't want to go too far because, on the one hand, I think that part of what would count as a success for my book is if Boltzmann gets raised to the level of Newton, Galileo, Einstein as a physicist who people on the street might know the name of.
Yes.
Boltzmann should be at that level of importance for our understanding of things. And he was an interesting character. And I think it's a little bit of an exaggeration to say no one bought into his ideas. It was actually part of the interest of the history is the nationalism of it. I mean, Boltzmann in 1895 visits England, and there's a conference organized, you know, around his ideas, and they were debating the fine points of kinetic theory, and he was on cloud nine. He was like, this is wonderful, science is marching forward, we're really learning a lot. Then he goes back and he tries to repeat that in Germany, and it was a disaster because people didn't even believe in atoms. You know, Ernst Mach was saying that these little things you can't observe, it shouldn't be part of science. And that was depressing for him. He was always quite... There's a great line that I quote in the book where he is writing in Nature, in the journal, a response to a criticism by Zermelo. And he says something along the lines of, well, I was at least pleased to see Herr Zermelo's paper because it means that someone in Germany has read my ideas. and that did trouble him. But he was also depressive. I mean, it was not the only time that he had tried to commit suicide. And there's a wonderful, he committed suicide in 1906, but in 1905, he traveled from Germany to Berkeley, to California, to give summer school lectures. And he wrote up a travelogue of his adventures in El Dorado, as he referred to California as El Dorado. And it's incredibly sprightly and amusing, and, you know, the spirit of life is everywhere there. So it's not like he was just moping around for the last 20 years of his life. You know, he went through phases when he was really quite excited and active, and then he was depressed at other times, and that's not an uncommon thing.
No, I think it's great that you actually do a lot of the history of stuff of this as well. I mean, the reason I mention that is that I frequently have experiences like saying to somebody who's an engineering student, oh, so tell me about entropy then, and then, so what do you know about Boltzmann? And they kind of go, who?
Right. Well, there is, you know, there's a lot to learn as a
yes.
student of science,
yes.
and there's something to be said for learning the material and then picking up the history later. And I think the different students sort of respond at a visceral level to different ways of presenting it. Some students love the history and the personalities, and they can't really understand it unless they get that. Others, like you said, are just sort of bothered by that and, you know, want to put it aside.
Well, if there's a gravestone in the Viennese Central Cemetery that says S equals K log W.
That's right. And the best
Why
thing is
that,
you know, there's an equation that statistical mechanics and cosmologists use all the time called the Boltzmann equation.
Yes.
And that's not even the equation on his gravestone, right? So that's not even his best equation. So right. I think he really deserves a lot more recognition than he gets in the public eye anyway.
So one of the great things about this book, if I may say so, is the footnotes.
Thank you.
This is not just a book. I mean, here, I picked a couple out because I thought it was hilariously funny, some of them as well, and engaging. Chapter 7, Running Time Backward. It is not known, at least to me, whether Newton himself actually played billiards, although the game certainly existed in Britain at the time. Immanuel Kant, on the other hand, is known to have made pocket money as a student playing billiards, as well as cards.
It humanizes these
Why
people,
don't
right?
you know whether Newton played billiards, Sean?
Well, I looked on Wikipedia and it wasn't there, so I'm not sure. Newton was not an active socializer, even compared to Immanuel Kant, so...
Let me give you another... here's another thing about the footnotes, incidentally. There are so many books about time out there. Here's a recent one by Dean Falk, all right?
Mm-hmm. And Dan Falk, yes.
Dan Falk, sorry, yes. And he's talking about... the various kinds of time, how philosophers have dealt with it, and so on. He mentions MacTaggart, mm-hmm. The British philosopher who spelled out the distinction between different kinds of time in the famous paper, The Unreality of Time, in 1908. Spends a few pages on this. for you, it becomes a footnote.
Yes.
And you say, well, philosophers often discuss different conceptions of time as laid out by MacTaggart, da da da. Then you sort of kill it with this final paragraph here. If you get the feeling that this purported contradiction seems more like a problem with language than one with the nature of time, you're on the right track. To a physicist, there seems to be no contradiction between stepping outside the universe and thinking of all of space-time at once, and admitting that from the point of view of any individual inside the universe, time seems to flow.
Well said, yes. I like that footnote. Good.
So, but to think of it in these cosmologist terms and physicist terms, when you talk to general audiences, do you have a sense that you're having trouble getting this across? I mean, it's just...
Well, I think you definitely need to...
Not intuitive.
Yeah, you need to recognize that when you're talking about things like time, you're not talking to an audience which is a blank slate. They experience time. They have a feeling of what it means. Even if right at the beginning of the book, as I say, you know, going back to St. Augustine, I know what time is even if I can't tell you what it is. You know, it's like obscenity in the Supreme Court justices, right? I know it when I see it, even if I can't give you a definition. Right. So I think that you have to recognize that. You can't pretend that I'm just going to tell you what time is and you're going to get it, especially because if you went and asked physicists on the street to define time, not only would you get different answers than if you asked other people on the street to define time, you get different kinds of answers. Physicists would talk about coordinates on space-time or things that clocks measure. They would really go back to the sort of clean, crisp, measuring time sort of conception, whereas people on the street actually are more in tune with entropy and the arrow of time at a visceral level. They'll tell you that time flows, that time is what keeps track of change in the universe and things like that. And yes, reconciling these conceptions is definitely part of your job if you're going to give a talk about what time means.
Okay, so when you use this headline, From Eternity to Here, you actually said that you, in the epilogue here, that once you come up with the title, it seemed irresistible. The connotations were perfect. On the one hand, a classic movie based on a classic novel, with that iconic scene of untamed waves from the Pacific crashing around Deborah Kerr and Burt Lancaster, caught in a passionate embrace, and on the other hand, the cosmological grandeur implicit in the word eternity. So let's deal with the eternity thing for a minute, okay? When you and David Albert came to one of our meetings, the Beyond Belief meetings that we do, and I've got David's book here as well. I specifically pressed you on some issues that were philosophical issues, and I did this also with Martin. If you start looking at philosophers like Spinoza, who talks about, has a scheme in which he talks about Deus sive natura, in other words, God meaning nature, or he talks about understanding things under the aspect of eternity, mm-hmm. subspecie eternitatis. And I pressed you both and said, look, isn't this relevant? I mean, don't you physicists have something to say about philosophy at the same time? I mean, isn't there something in John Stuart Bell's work about and this new work on entanglement and so on? Doesn't that all fit together? And it's really tough to get a straight answer on that. Can we have another go at it?
Sure. I mean, the short answer is yes, I'm sure it all does fit together. But then you want to say, okay, tell me how. Right, and then it becomes a little bit fuzzier. But I do think, let me just say parenthetically, that it's fascinating to look back at the, in history, the discussions of entropy in the Arrow of Time, sort of after Boltzmann's work in 1870s, it becomes clear that there is something, there's a lacuna, there's something to be explained. Why was the entropy low in the past? And like I said, they believed in eternity at the time. They believed in a Newtonian space and time that is absolute and lasts forever. So there's no beginning to appeal to. And over the next several decades, an argument goes back and forth. Quite a vociferous debate is going on. And it kind of shuts off in the early 20th century, I think partly because of the Big Bang, partly because we realize that the universe we live in does not seem to be eternal. It seems to have a beginning. And that doesn't answer the question, but it changes the nature of the question, and we hid our lack of understanding under the rug of the Big Bang, saying, yeah, we don't know what happens at the Big Bang, but it's the beginning. And years thereafter, cosmologists were very, very fond of imagining not only a Big Bang, but a Big Crunch. They said, well, the universe could be closed in both space and time, and so we can ask questions like, if the universe recollapses, would time's arrow reverse? Would entropy start going down? And that's a big debate that goes back and forth. And therefore, people didn't quite come to terms with what if it doesn't recollapse? What if it actually expands forever? And then in 1998, we discover dark energy accelerating the universe. There's no sign that the universe will recollapse. And that presses home a very important problem. The universe is 14 billion years old in the observable part of the universe. Right. But it will last in the future forever, okay? At the least, if you want to say, you can actually assign a expiration date to the universe by saying that it's a finite system, any little part of the universe is finite and will eventually repeat itself. You can ask how long it will take to repeat itself, and the answer is 10 to the 10 to the 120 years. Some enormously long length of time. And here we are in the first 14 billion years of the universe. What is going on that we are in this wildly, wildly unrepresentative moment in the history of the universe? And that is the question of eternity. Sort of, you know, we think that the universe is old because we look back at the past. We have trouble predicting the future, but our models make predictions for the future. And we're not yet psychologically in our guts taking those predictions seriously. We're not really quite coming to terms with eternity yet, I think. So I'm absolutely of the opinion that we're not there yet in our understanding, and we're going to have to grapple with eternity. And in particular, I think that a big step will be believing that the Big Bang is not the beginning, that in fact there's eternity in both directions. Nothing in the laws of physics that we really do claim to understand says that there should be a beginning to time. If you look at quantum mechanics and Schrodinger's equation, there's a parameter in there, t for time, and it doesn't end. It goes from minus infinity to infinity. And if you asked most working physicists if quantum mechanics was likely to survive, they would say yes. If you ask whether general relativity, which predicts a Big Bang, is likely to survive as part of the fundamental architecture, they will say no. General relativity is sort of an approximation to something deeper. So I think that we need to struggle with eternity in a way that we haven't yet. And in fact, that's sort of the major motivating force in my research right now, is to say, what does it mean to live in an eternal universe? How do you make predictions? How do you say what looks natural or what looks unnatural? What should you expect to see in such a situation?
So, I mean, there's a link to religion here, plainly. It's, you know, because Newton is also, whether the scientist of the millennium or not, is still thinking about religion and so on and so forth. The Arrow of Time, that phrase is Eddington's phrase, right?
That's right.
So that's the late 20s, 1927. Yes. And the Big Bang, what's the date on that?
1920s. No, the 1920s is when Friedman first put it together, and then Lemaître actually starts talking about the primeval atom. And, you know,
but Hoyle is later than this.
Right? Hoyle, yes, the phrase the Big Bang is later than that, but the idea of the Big Bang is from the 1920s.
Okay, so that's comparatively recent, in fact, then.
Yes.
Could you make a... am I making a spurious link there between religious views and the way in which theories are constituted initially?
Well, I think that, scientists are human beings, and they're influenced by all sort of non-epistemic factors when they find things interesting, when they make hypotheses, when they decide what is the route to go down in the future. Lemaître is a great case study because he is a priest. He's a Jesuit priest. He's the first person to take seriously the idea of the Big Bang and the idea that general relativity predicts a moment before which we cannot speak. And nevertheless, he was very, very strict about making no religious conclusions from that discovery. Other people did. Other people leapt in. But he says, this is science. You know, my faith is not based on natural philosophy, on things that I observe about the world. My faith is elsewhere. I'm trying to learn about the universe. So I think that, you know, I'm not religious. I can't tell religious people what to think or what to believe. I think that taking eternity seriously, thinking about how the universe came to be, is not easy. We have no guidelines for doing it. But the ultimate criteria for judging whether an idea is useful or useless, helpful or not, are not going to be religious. They're going to be about explanatory power and fitting the data.
It's interesting about Lemaître, because I mentioned to Martin Rees yesterday, who's amongst one of his honorary titles is Astronomer Royal.
Right.
That the first Astronomer Royal was the Reverend John Flamsteed. And yes. Astronomy, of course, was a topic that where many divines were involved in the early days.
Yeah, sure, so.
It says in your Wikipedia entry, by the way, under religious beliefs, Carroll is an outspoken atheist who argues that scientific thinking leads to one to a materialist worldview. He turned down an invitation to speak at a conference sponsored by the John Templeton Foundation on the grounds that he did not want to appear to be supporting a reconciliation between science and religion.
That's correct.
And of course, you were at Beyond Belief and so on. What's your sense of being in part of this interesting turmoil that's been going on for the last few years with the new atheists and so on? What's mm-hmm. your sense of how that trajectory is moving?
Well, I think it's very complicated, actually. I mean, it's a very good question because just like thinking about eternity, thinking about religion in this very moment in history is it's not clear where we're going to go next. I think that the so-called new atheists, Dawkins and Dennett and Hitchens and so forth, and Sam Harris, have done an immensely good service by changing the Overton window, by changing what counts as a something to talk about and take seriously. I mean, atheists always lose these polls in, you know, the United States about who is the group you would least like your daughter to marry, right? You know, the atheists are at the bottom, below gays and Muslims and criminals and so forth. And so the idea that there are respectable people who don't believe in God, who do not take for granted that goodness comes from a higher power and so forth, is a good idea to get out there on the table of things that need to be taken seriously. Having said that, I think that there's a long way to go between the kind of rhetoric that we've had from those people who have really just been trying to establish that atheism is on the table and has a good reason to believe it's true, to turn it into something that is actually a productive force. I mean, there's nothing in the God delusion that is going to be persuasive to a housewife in the Midwest who enjoys going to church and gets useful advice from that. I mean, I think that we need to have some sort of positive agenda where we say that here is how you can behave like a good person and make sense of the world without believing in God. I'm not that interested in refuting arguments for the existence of God so much as I am figuring out how to live in a universe governed by the laws of nature.
One of the things that we said in that early Beyond Belief rubric, the discussion of it, was here's one of the questions. Can you be good without God? Here's another question. Is it possible to use science to come up with a narrative that is as inspiring, powerful, poetic in many ways, mm-hmm. as the narratives that have inspired millions for millennia?
Right.
My guess is that you're betting that eventually you can come up with that kind of a narrative, and that this, the kind of subject matter you're talking about, is part of that narrative. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but...
No, I think so. I mean, but I think that ultimately, even if you couldn't, science still has the benefit of being true. And therefore, okay, you know, no matter how inspiring the narrative is, you know, truth is going to have to be the arbiter of what you should believe in.
I'm not suggesting that the raison d'etre for science right. is to come up with a narrative. No.
Well, but nevertheless, I think that, you know, you need to sort of change your viewpoint about what would qualify, what makes you inspired or gives you purpose or meaning in your life. When you go from living in a world full of non-human spirits and consciousnesses and intelligences to a world where we are a complicated chemical reaction governed by the laws of physics. And I think it can be done, and we're taking steps toward that. I don't think that we have it yet.
So almost the last few pages here of the epilogue, there's a subhead, The Search for Meaning in a Preposterous Universe.
Right.
Do you want to just expand on that a little?
Well, I think that, you know, as you mentioned before, we have gone through, thanks to science, a series of transformations that make us smaller and smaller parts of the universe, less and less important to the general functioning of everything that we see around us. And so we can't, if we take that seriously, and I think that we should, then we can't just say, you know, we're the reason why the universe is here, that the universe cares about what is going on, that there is some purpose given to us outside ourselves. So, but instead, that doesn't mean that all things are just as good as all other things. There's no such thing as right and wrong or love or anything like that. It means that we need to create meaning ourselves, that we need to decide what is right and what is wrong, what that means to us, where beauty comes from, how to live a just and fulfilling life, and things like that. So it's a big task, right? I mean, it's not something where you just ask the question, the answer pops into your lap, and both at the sort of philosophical level of answering the question and at the rhetorical level of convincing people that your answer is right, I think we have a lot of work to do.
And that work is work that scientists have to do. This is a point that I've made to a number of people. This nice new book that you probably know by Cornelia Dean from the New York Times, Corey Dean, Am I Making Myself Clear? A Scientist's Guide to Talking to the Public.
Right.
Implicit in what you just said is a requirement. It's incumbent upon scientists, I think anyway, to at least try and make clear what it is that they're using taxpayers' money to do.
Well, I would say it's incumbent upon science to do that, not every scientist.
Not
some
every
scientist. You just don't want to talk to the public,
the community
really.
should have people who are capable of.
Absolutely. Very All strongly right. believe that.
The dangers of that, of course, is oversimplifying and so on, overselling and so on. What's your experience of that and working with public audiences? I mean,
my experience is that we are dramatically underserving the public appetite for discussions about things like that. I mean, it's complicated stuff what we do for a living, but people lap it up. It can be made intelligible if you put effort into it. I don't think it's a matter of oversimplifying or dumbing it down. I think it's a matter of putting it into vocabularies that people can understand, sticking to the parts that are actually interesting, not just to the technical researchers in some subfield, but to a wider audience, and trying to get the spirit of the activity across, not just the details of what you've learned. What does it mean to be doing science as opposed to be doing something else? My wife Jennifer works at reconciling science with Hollywood, at bringing together directors and filmmakers with scientists to improve the science in their movies. And the point is not to get the right constellations in the sky. The point is to capture what it means to be doing experiments, to test hypotheses, that it's not just magic. And my favorite recent movie along those lines is Iron Man, because in the whole middle of Iron Man, you have billionaire playboy engineer Tony Stark in his lab. He's constructing things, he's doing planning, he's building things, he's doing experiments. He flies in the suit and it doesn't work the first several times, and he goes back and tries to fix it. And even if building a magic suit that gets you to fly around is not what a good scientist could do, the way that he does it is absolutely in tune with the spirit of how science is done. So I think that that's, you know, going to be part of our rhetorical strategy, is to sort of not just get science right, not to sort of be documentarians every time we talk about science, but to get across the feeling this is not just a set of facts that you memorize. This is a process and a feeling that is quite an amazing one. It gives us these amazing truths about the universe.
So that would be an initiative of the National Academies of Sciences, the Science Entertainment Exchange.
That's right.
And your wife is Jennifer Ouellette, who's also written some nice books about the Buffyverse, right?
That's right. Buffy the Vampire Slayer and the physics within it. Yes. And the point is that, you know, and it's been great for me from the outside to see directors and screenwriters talk to scientists, because they find this common ground very quickly in puzzle solving. Both a scientist and a storyteller wants to have a logical structure, right? No one is impressed if your story is saved by magical angels coming in at the end of the movie and saving the hero. You know, that's just very, very unsatisfying. There has to be an obstacle, there have to be rules, and you have to overcome the obstacle. And that puzzle solving is a very similar process to a scientist trying to figure out why this boson is decaying more slowly than it should.
I noticed the dedication of the book as well. I was to Jennifer for all time.
For all time, I couldn't resist time. That. Yes, I mean, that's right.
It's fine. I'm not going to
press. It's very good if you're writing a book.
I'm not going to press you on that one.
Well, you know, it's a great thing when you're writing a book to be married to a professional writer and editor. It's very helpful, let's just put it that way.
This connection with the fact that time extends into literature, into poetry. I mean, you know, what do I pick up here? Here's Eliot.
Yes.
Now, but I was going to ask you this. Here's the opening of Burnt Norton, right? Yes. Which is the first of the four quartets. Time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future, and time future contained in time past. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. And it goes on, as you know, go, go, says the bird. Mankind cannot stand reality and bear too much reality and so on. But this is extraordinary. You must have some comment on this sort of thing.
Yes, the comment is that it's copyrighted and I couldn't quote it. In the galleys, it's there. It was in the book, but I was told, you know, poetry is different than prose. In prose, you can, you know, get a few lines, fair use, you can quote it. Poetry, like every syllable, matters, so you don't have quite the fair use rights.
Ah, but...
So it got taken out last minute. But it's, no, it's very vivid.
But I thought it would have fitted rather well with your thesis.
Yeah, yeah, and likewise, I think there was a Borges quote also.
Right, yeah, you know,
some people are just more prickly than others. Some estates, not some people, about what we can include.
But the point is, of course this stuff turns up in novels. Of course it turns up in movies.
I mean, a good friend of mine, who is a TV director and is now in his mid-80s, read the book and liked it very much, but kept telling me, you need to talk more about mortality. When you reach a certain age, the fact that you have fewer years in front of you than behind you becomes very, very relevant, and you need to, you know, emphasize that point more. And I'm not in a position to say that much about that point, but it's true. You know, time is something that is not just an abstract concept that belongs to the physicists. It's something that is absolutely crucial to how we live our lives and how we conceptualize how we go through it.
Well, there are papers written, which I have in the office there, about why it appears that time goes faster as you grow older.
Yes, that's right. So that's one of the very first questions that people ask, and I have to say that's a biology/neuroscience question, that's not a physics question.
Yeah, well, they're all part of the same playground,
yes,
aren't they?
That's right.
You mentioned Borges as well. I mean, there's also, Yeats, Sailing mm-hmm. to Byzantium. There's an old poet writing of what is past or passing or to come, and so on. There's lots of wonderful, rich references here. And the two fragments from Heraclitus that are at the beginning of Burnt Norton, the second one translates about the way up and the way down, are one and the same. So that fits quite
well. It does, and you know, poetry does not reach scientific truths because, you know, for everything that looks like a substantive claim in a poem, you can find another poem that makes the opposite substantive claim. But it illuminates truths that exist, right? It makes you think about things in ways that you might not have thought about them otherwise by putting them in contexts and connecting them with concepts that the more straightforwardly minded scientist wouldn't put together.
You have in your footnotes, in your voluminous footnotes, which is a kind of a second book, I must say, applaudingly, you have references to, there's Tom Stoppard in there, who uses that in his plays like Arcadia.
Absolutely, yeah, it's crucial.
You've got Alan Lightman's book, Einstein's mm-hmm. Dreams, that classic book about, again, that's a time shift, really, isn't it? A different perspective on...
Yeah, no, Einstein's Dream is a great thought experiment of coming up with, you know, of illuminating what we mean by time by imagining how it could be different. And he did it in a fictional context that I thought was really genius.
Yeah, and on my way back from France last time, I picked up this book by Michel Houellebecq mm-hmm. called Atomized.
I don't know that one.
No, well, but this, it's, here's page 145. When he first met Dzerzhinsky, was in his third year at the University of Orsay. As part of his studies, he took part in Alain Aspect's groundbreaking experiment showing that the behaviors of successive photons emitted from a single calcium atom were inseparable. Michel was the youngest researcher on the team. Aspect's experiments, precise, rigorous, and perfectly documented, were to have profound repercussions in the scientific community. And he goes on to talk about Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, mm-hmm. and leads into John Stuart Bell and so mm-hmm. on. So let me use this as a device to get you back to that topic, and also the stuff in Louisa Gilder's new book, mm-hmm. The Age of Entanglement. There was a time when the Aspect experiment was hailed and people thought, oh my gosh, David Bohm was right, John Stuart Bell was right. There was this extraordinary interconnectedness or right. you know, talk about non-locality and so on and so forth. And then it went away. Hmm. And then apparently a lot of people seem to be migrating into that discipline, maybe because their sort of string theory became not a good area to work in or something. But now we have lots of people talking about entanglement. You're in the community mm-hmm. of physicists, cosmologists. Can you give me some sense of what that shift might have been or whether I'm imagining it?
Well, I think it's complicated and subtle. I mean, there's certainly absolutely a growth in fundamental physicists working in quantum mechanics. We've been using quantum mechanics ever since the 1920s, right? I mean, all of elementary particle physics is based on quantum mechanics. A large part of condensed matter physics and, you know, very down-to-earth material science is based on quantum mechanics, not to mention atomic physics and chemistry and all these things. But these are putting quantum mechanics to work. And studying quantum mechanics for its own sake is something that very few people have done in the last 80 years. People like Bell or Bohm are sort of tiny, you know, idiosyncratic community of people. It was not accepted. But now, any good physics department has people studying quantum information theory and quantum computing and interpretations of quantum mechanics. And I think it's, like many things, it's partly technology-driven. We can reach that realm now that is on the dividing line between the quantum and the classical. If you have one atom or one elementary particle, then it's quantum mechanics. If you have a brick or a baseball, then it's classical mechanics. You need to have sort of a group of atoms that you can really control carefully. And now that has become real with laser cooling and ion traps and a whole new set of technologies. And like the experiments that Aspect and others have done with entanglement, keeping entanglement real over macroscopic scales. And it turns out to have interesting real-world consequences. The National Security Agency is fascinated by whether or not you can use a quantum computer to factor prime numbers very quickly, which would make a lot of codes and encryption schemes obsolete if it were true. Sending messages securely over the internet could rely on details of quantum mechanics. Furthermore, ideas about quantum gravity and black holes and string theory turn out to be closely related to ideas about information loss and decoherence and entanglement. So I think that it's a combination of new theoretical ideas and new technology that are making us go back and do things that we could have done in 1935, right? I mean, it's not some new change in our theory has come to pass. It's just that we are now interested in digging into the guts of our theory in a new way. And I actually am extremely interested in applying these kinds of ideas to cosmology and the beginning of the universe. I think that one of the things holding us back in understanding the Big Bang is our relentless insistence in talking about space and time. And I think that space and time are probably things that are approximations to some quantum mechanical reality, to things that should be emerging from some wave function of the universe. And if that's true, it might be helpful in describing how the Big Bang is just something that happens. It's not the beginning of time itself. It's just one moment in the evolution of some wave function. We'll see. You know, this is actually a field that is fairly new. It's certainly useful for some things. It's not useful. It's not clear how useful it will be for the questions that I'm interested in, but I'm optimistic. I'm interested in thinking about it.
All right, so I'm not a card-carrying physicist, so help me out here. If I'm browsing through Nature or Science and I come across a paper by Anton Zeilinger, mm-hmm. and then I read a headline writer somewhere who's written a piece about it in a public consumption journal and makes references to Star Trek and right. What's that little machine where
Teleporter.
The teleporter and so on. What do I do with that?
Well, I don't know what to do with it. That's a perfectly good question. Even physicists who spend their lives thinking about quantum mechanics are still not very good at talking about quantum mechanics. It's so far removed from the language of the macroscopic everyday world that we haven't invented the right language. And so people argue, you know, over words like reality, locality, communication, information, all these words that we use every day, it's not clear how to apply them to quantum mechanics. And you find people like Anthony Leggett, Sir Anthony Leggett, who won the Nobel Prize in 2003, participated in my Arrow of Time symposium yesterday, doesn't believe in quantum mechanics. He thinks that we can do better. He thinks it's a stepping stone, and he's thinking, you know, very, very hard about how we can do better and what that would mean. And his most recent ideas involve retrocausality, involving things that are happening today happening because of something that's going to happen tomorrow. And so I think that there's a wide playground open for where things are going to go. I don't think it's easy to put things in understandable terms because the terms are different. I mean, I have a whole chapter in my book where I really try hard to explain quantum mechanics and entanglement in a way that I don't think is usually explained. I think that the words I use are a little bit different. Yeah. I can't tell you that they're better words. I like them. I think it makes sense to me. But even, you know, I'm very quick to say that quantum mechanics, even though it works, even though it was established in the 1920s, even though we can use it and solve the equations, we don't understand it. And I think that's fascinating.
It's what Feynman used to say, isn't it?
That's right,
if you think you understand it.
Well, my favorite, I think there was a quote by him, something like, you know, he was poo-pooing this legend of Eddington being asked about general relativity. And, you know, Eddington was asked, is it true that there's only three people who understand Einstein's general theory of relativity? And Eddington thinks for a second and says, I'm trying to think of who the third one is. And Feynman says, very, very correctly, that that is absolute hogwash. You know, general relativity was a fantastic accomplishment, but the tools were there to understand it. And as soon as Einstein published it, there were plenty of people who understood it. And then he says, on the other hand, it's safe to say that no one understands quantum mechanics. That is not an exaggeration.
So let me just ask you about this cover of Discover magazine then, since you...
Sure.
The new rules of time travel. What are the new rules of time travel?
They're not that new. I think that the sense in which they're new is the sense in which we now are able to speak about time travel scientifically. We don't know if it's possible, but since Einstein gave us this picture of space and time as things that are flexible and can be manipulated, time travel goes from being magic to something that we can at least imagine how it might happen. Whether or not we know if it can happen or not, we can at least say what it would be like if it did happen. So it's not in particular that you hop in a booth and then you dematerialize and you reappear in the past, okay? That's no more true than to get from here to New York, you hop in a booth and are teleported. You hop in an airplane or in a car. You travel between every single point. And likewise, we now are able to come up with what our time machines, you know, in our equations, not in the real world, describe what they are. But what they are things where you would hop in a rocket ship, you would travel to some region of extremely strong gravitational field, you would travel back, but you would get back before you left. And that way of thinking about time machines brings with it some implications, some rules. So you can't change the past. The past happened, okay? You don't disappear. There's no flashing lights. You get in a rocket ship. And so if you know, depending on how respectable you want to be, if you're going to write the next Hollywood blockbuster for Steven Spielberg, you can be very, very scientifically accurate and have a time travel movie. In fact, Kip Thorne is doing exactly that right now. He's working with Steven Spielberg on writing a movie that will involve wormholes and time travel. I think that's a great thing.
Wow. So, I mean, Kip Thorne, again, there's some very interesting little footnotes about
yes.
Kip Thorne in the book.
That's right. Well,
which I will not reveal. People can go and read that one. Before we skip off to the next topic, the final word on the entanglement and so on, I'm thinking now about Jeremy Bernstein's nice little book, Quantum Leaps, and so mm-hmm. on, in which he talks about Bohm to some extent. There's references to Krishnamurti, the Indian sage, and who Bohm used to visit and spend time having conversations with. Clearly, that view of the universe does lend itself to larger Eastern perceptions of how the universe is comported, right?
I suppose so.
I have a feeling you don't want to go in this direction.
Well, no, I have nothing very interesting
what
to
can
say,
we say
about it.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. No, I do want to say, I mean, there's one thing that's worth saying, that some of the most basic lessons of quantum mechanics sort of get very hidden in traditional popularizations of the subject. I mean, to me, and in fact, you know, I talk to friends of mine who are professors at Caltech, and who I notice don't understand quantum mechanics. And you know, they use quantum mechanics every day, but here's a single basic fact, that before quantum mechanics, you had a particle here and you had a particle there, and it made sense to talk about the state of this particle and the state of that particle. In quantum mechanics, you can't do that. That makes no sense. There's one state of the universe, including that particle and that particle. There's one wave function of the universe. There are not separate wave functions for each individual thing in the universe. And that's just quantum mechanics. That's not, you know, any advanced interpretation. That is not any wild, mystical way of thinking about it. That's what Schrödinger wrote down, okay? The way to describe the universe has one wave function, not 10 to the 88th wave functions for every particle in the universe. And so, and that's where entanglement comes from and so forth. And I think that has implications for unanswered questions about space and time and gravity. You know, if that's true, then there's one wave function for the geometry of space-time itself. And locality is not something we should expect to exist in the universe. Locality is a surprise. It's probably some approximation that is useful to us, but it's not a fundamental deep-down principle.
While you are on tour with this book, at the same time on tour was Rebecca Neuberger-Goldstein. Mm-hmm. Whose new book is 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction. But I noticed this morning as I was thinking about this that her argument number 4 in the appendix, because she has these arguments in the appendix,
right.
Is the argument from the Big Bang.
Yes. The argument that Lemaître did not give.
And she gives two flaws. The flaws in this are that cosmologists themselves do not all agree that the Big Bang is a singularity. And flaw 2, that the argument from the Big Bang has all the flaws of the cosmological argument. It passes the buck from the mystery of the origin of the universe to the mystery of the origin of God. And it extends the notion of cause outside the domain of events covered by natural laws, also known as the universe, where it no longer makes sense. So I just thought that was a nice, interesting parallel event going on at the same time.
Well, I think that, and it's true
in
that...
In the same universe.
If you were the kind of person who would like to give in to the temptation to explain certain features of our observable universe by appealing to higher powers outside our observable universe, the Big Bang would be a very natural place to go, right? I mean, that is something where the current state of science is not able to tell you everything that happened. My job as a scientist, as I see it, is to push naturalistic explanations as far as they can, and we're nowhere near being able to say that there is no dynamical, robust explanation for why the Big Bang is like it is. So we don't have it yet, but people like me are proposing models, trying to move closer to that. And so anyone who tries to say that, I mean, clearly you need God to explain the beginning of the universe, and in fact science has told us where that event is, I don't think is justified.
Okay, not on solid ground. You said my role as a scientist. Let me ask you to think a bit larger than that. This is a question I've been asking a lot of people in this 350th anniversary year of the foundation of the Royal Society. So I'm thinking about the business of science, mm-hmm. and its operation. And I'm also thinking about President Obama's inaugural address, where he talked about restoring science to its rightful place.
Right.
And did not give the coordinates. So in your view, do you have some sense of what you think the rightful place of science is in this society?
Well, I think there's more than one place that is rightful for science. I mean, science, the most obvious thing is that science leads to technology and leads to things we can do to manipulate the world that might help us in various ways, you know, from laptops and cell phones to trying to fix the environment from the disaster that we're subjecting it to right now. However, what I do for a living is completely useless as far as those goals are concerned. I cannot justify theoretical cosmology or quantum gravity or quantum information theory on the basis of building better transistors or clean energy or anything like that. I think it's purely curiosity driven. And it's in that sense, very closely related to poetry or art or great food or anything like that, except that it's more expensive. You can do poetry a lot cheaper than you can do cosmology. But I think that the place of theoretical cosmology is similar. I mean, it's part of what makes us human beings. It's part of what elevates us above merely surviving from day to day. We are curious about our universe, and that curiosity and the empirical method of satisfying it has led us to these absolutely amazing discoveries. And like I said, if you're telling people about these discoveries in an open and accessible way, people can't get enough. You know, some people are scared off, they had bad experiences in high school, they're defensive about the fact that they don't understand a lot about math or physics or whatever. But if you approach them with the idea that, look, this is not eating your vegetables, this is a wonderful dessert, this is a treat, we get to learn about the universe, I think that people really do open up and appreciate it a lot. So part of the place of science is helping us, you know, learn about our universe and become better human beings by participating in this grand project.
How did you actually get into this in the first place? You talked about, you know, high school and so on. Did you have some positive experience in high school? Were your parents scientists? What was the impetus?
I come from a long line of steelworkers, so my parents were not scientists or academic in any way. There were no books lying around my house, but I loved books. So I, you know, haunted the local public library in the, you know, the 600 section or whatever it was, of the Dewey Decimal System, where all the physics books were. And I read about, you know, particle accelerators and the Big Bang and general relativity and George Gamow's books, and just fell in love with this idea that this is, you know, we've learned all these wonderful things about the universe. And when I was 10 years old, I decided that this is what I want to do, even though I had no idea what that meant. I had no idea there was something called graduate school, something called being a professor, how you would earn a living doing this. But if it, clearly someone was earning a living thinking about where the universe came from, and I wanted that to be me.
And why this particular, how did you end up on this particular trajectory?
What was I have the, no idea. I do not recall what it was.
No specific teacher, mentor in this particular
books.
Case?
I was reading books. Why did I start reading those books?
I'm just autodidactic.
Not sure. Yeah, I don't know what happened. I mean, someone must have given me a book, right? There must have been some first book that got me interested in this stuff, and I can't really tell you what it is or why I got that book.
Okay, so in terms of the scientists that you've encountered, or the ones that in history that you've thought of, this is my dinner party question. Mm-hmm. In fact, it doesn't even have to be scientists. Mm-hmm. If I gave you carte blanche to do a time travel, mm-hmm. you can bring anybody in from anywhere in the multiverse. Who would you like to have for dinner?
It would be a pretty big party. I mean, you got to keep the party small because you can't talk to anyone otherwise. So I'm not sure. I would love to get Thomas Pynchon there because he's such a recluse that I don't know what he would be like as a person. And he is someone whose books I love and who uses scientific concepts in a very interesting way. Scientifically, it's very hard to tell because I think it's a mistake to extrapolate from people's scientific contributions to their personalities, right? Mm-hmm. Because I don't want Isaac Newton at my dinner table. I would love to have Galileo. I think Galileo would be a lot of fun.
Wow, that's interesting.
I mean, I read Tom Levinson wrote this great new book about Newton in his post-scientific career, prosecuting criminals and sending them to the gallows for being counterfeiters. No, I do not want to have Newton at my dinner table. I'm sure he'd have a lot of things to say. I'm sure that he would turn people off while saying it. You know, I would like to go for some of the sort of highly recognized but not absolute pantheon people like Enrico Fermi, who I think I give huge credit to Time magazine, actually. You know, number one, when they had the person of the century, they picked Einstein, which I thought was an inspired choice among all the politicians and sports figures you could have picked. But number two, the other physicist that they mentioned in that issue for the 20th century was Enrico Fermi. I thought that was wonderful because he's really the last giant who is both an amazing experimenter and amazing theorist at the same time.
Yeah, I was actually just going to say to you, what about Enrico Fermi? What about Leo Szilard? And you went
Fermi,
to
I would like
Fermi.
John von Neumann would be a wonderful person. In fact, you mentioned Szilard, and there was this period, you know, in the early 20th century when Hungary seemed to be coming out with all these geniuses. Szilard was one of them, and I think it was Szilard who was asked, you know, what is in the water in Hungary that is producing all these geniuses? And he says, I don't know, you're talking about all these geniuses. There's only one genius from Hungary, and that's John von Neumann. Yeah. And I think he's underappreciated. He's, again, highly appreciated, yet underappreciated, because he did things in so many different areas that no one quite grasps the whole thing that he did. He put quantum mechanics on a mathematically sensible footing. He invented game theory. He did a lot of modern economics. There are sort of two major paradigms for computer organization, one of which is called von Neumann computers, the other one of which is called non-von Neumann computers, and he invented both of them. So I would love to just talk to him and see what he has to say about, you know, the modern world and where we are.
Yeah, you obviously read widely. You obviously like poetry. I know that, and all the dimensions of time here will get you into all sorts of different. If you had not been a scientist, is there anything else that you could conceivably have entertained doing as a?
Well, I think that if it hadn't been a scientist, the most likely thing would have been some other sort of academic or professor. You know, the academic life is very congenial to me. The intellectual life. It might have been a law professor. I think that actually I would enjoy this. Law has these sort of logic puzzles that science has, but in a human domain without all the equations. And, you know, getting things right is sort of, it's almost like philosophy, I think. And so philosophy or law, I think I could have done. And if not that, I would have tried to make a living as some sort of creative writer. I'm not sure how well I would have done at that. That's something that sounds like a lot of fun to me, but I don't know how good I am at it.
Okay. This is really for younger scientists in terms of the trajectory that they can expect. Often when I talk to people, they say that they got into something and it was just serendipity, just something came along. And they also say that some of them have got stories about mistakes they've made, but in mm-hmm. fact, which are the biggest learn that they ever had. Did you recall anything like that?
Life is a long series of mistakes. So it was never one big mistake. It was many small mistakes that I was able to recover from. But, you know, I had a quixotic path to getting here. I went to a large public high school. I did not come from an academic family. I went to a middle-sized Catholic university because they gave me a full tuition scholarship. I applied to graduate school, and I really wanted to go to Princeton, and they wouldn't let me in. I really wanted to go to Harvard, and they wouldn't let me in. And so I sneaked into the astronomy department at Harvard because the physics department wouldn't accept me. And then, you know, I worked with my advisor who knew no more about theoretical cosmology than I did, and we had great fun exploring different things and learning with each other. And then I bounced around in postdocs sort of for a while before they discovered that the universe was accelerating. And that may be a hot property because I was one of the world's experts at that, but I had nothing to do with it. I was just in the right place at the right time. So, no, I mean, I've never been following what someone told me to do. I've always been doing what I, you know, have liked to do, and often that has gotten me in trouble. You know, I think it has been a learning experience, and I've ended up in a great place. I don't have great admiration for people who insist on their quixotic vision to the exclusion of everything else and to the exclusion of everyone else's attempts to explain to them that that might not be the right answer. I think that it's, no matter how passionate you are about your own approach to things, it behooves us to be respectful about other people's approaches to things. And I tell my students that there are things you're interested in, there are things the rest of the world is interested in, and it's not a compromise of your integrity to work at the intersection of those things. And if you find there is no intersection between what you're interested in and what the rest of the world is interested in, then you might be in the wrong field. You know, you might be a lone genius who is going to overthrow, you know, all of our understanding of space and time, or you might just have blinders on and not be paying attention to the good judgment of a lot of other people. So I'm kind of a moderate in that sort of intellectual sense. I try to, you know, not do things just because people think it's the thing to do, but I do try to pay attention to what other people think is the thing to do.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to ask you about, you're one of the co-founders, co-editors of a blog called Cosmic Variance.
That's right.
So I wanted to ask you, which I suppose, full disclosure, that's now a Discover blog, right?
Yeah, it's on Discover blogs.
So, you know, you've got a cover story in Discover, full disclosure. But I'm interested in knowing how the blog came to be, who your colleagues are, and whether you think, make a comment for me on the fact that so many science writers have been sacked, science journalists, science sections of newspapers going away. The blogosphere has increased in size, but it's not clear to me. I mean, a number of scientists have actually complained about the level of expertise in blogs, and they feel like they're being tried by people who don't have the credentials to try them.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you have the credentials, but could you?
Well, I think that I mean, blogs are a complicated thing. It's a medium. It's not a message. A blog can be anything. It can be, Richard Posner and Gary Heckman have a blog. You know, Nobel Prize winners and important jurists, and a bunch of crackpots have blogs. You know, talking about physics and so forth. So the fact that something is a blog should neither be a condemnation nor an approbation. I mean, it's just someone talking about something. It is interesting to me that physicists have been less ready to blog, to start their own blogs and to talk in that medium than other academics have. Economists, social scientists, law professors, it's like you're embarrassed if you don't have a blog. It's so common and it's very high-level discussions. Whereas there's very few physicists who have blogs. I think that our blog at Cosmic Variance is sort of half of the faculty level bloggers doing physics out there right now. And I'm not quite sure why that is true. It's some part of reluctance to engage in public conversation. We've had great guest bloggers. You know, we've invited some very good people in to blog just once. Another thing is that people think that it's work, right? Like, why are you wasting time that you could be doing research, you're wasting it blogging. But to me, it's not replacing work. It's a hobby. It's like, you know, I go to the movies or I watch TV or something like that. Instead of that, I write my blog. It's no more than, you know, half an hour a day at the very most, usually less than that. And for that cost, I reach thousands and thousands of people talking about science and whatever I want to talk about. So I'm not sure what the future will be. I think that you mentioned science journalism hitting hard times, and that is absolutely true, and I think this is a tremendous tragedy and a disaster. I think it's not necessarily the end of the world, because I think that we're in flux. We're in between different paradigms, and we're moving from one to another. I don't know what the other one is going to be. Blogs are not going to replace journalism, either in politics or in science. Scientists are really good at talking about their own individual thing that they're interested in, but they're never going to do the dirty work of being a journalist, calling people up, checking sources, writing pieces because they should be written, not because they themselves are interested in it. So it's going to have to be some sort of teamwork, some sort of synergy between professional journalists, bloggers, scientists. I'm just not quite sure what the model is going to be.
Yeah, and this actually, the shutting down of science pages actually does baffle me to some extent, because one knows by looking at cover of Time magazine, there's so many science stories that they acknowledge as being things which obviously must sell magazines.
Yeah, in the New York Times did a study. They found that the Science Times stories are the most emailed stories in the newspaper.
So there's a disconnect here, isn't there?
Yeah, and I'm not an editor of a newspaper, so I'm not quite sure what is going on. I think that what might happen is that things like Discover and New Scientist and Scientific American continue to thrive.
Yes.
The people who are actually the publications that are for people interested in science, which is great, but it would be terrible if the people just sort of watching the general news or reading the general newspaper just get absolutely no science at all, and that's a very real possibility. I'm not quite sure what to do about it.
Scientific American, of course, now, which has all these other versions as well, Scientific American Mind and so on, now part of Nature Publishing Group as well.
That's so, right. Publishing world is in flux, let's just put it that way, put it very politely.
If you were in the presence of a room full of card-carrying physicists, I don't know who agrees with you, who disagrees with you, but people of the caliber of, you know, Brian Greene, Lisa Randall, Tony Leggett, so on and so forth, what are the best criticisms there are that you have to face about your thoughts on this time issue?
Well, it's ambitious. I mean, just like string theory, ideas in cosmology about the multiverse are reaching beyond what is next to us, right? We're reaching into realms that it's very hard to know how to come back and bring some tangible result. How do you know if it's true? What do you measure? What is the experiment you do to distinguish between different theories? And I am absolutely not sympathetic to the ideas that you're not really doing science unless you can tell me right now, here and now, what is the experiment you can do to test your idea. I think that sometimes it takes longer than that. Sometimes it's a gradual process. You build up both ideas and experimental capabilities. But it may be true that the time is not right now to be thinking about what happened at the Big Bang or to be thinking about how to quantize gravity. It might just be that that's something for the next century, that we're not there yet. But the only way to find out if that's true is by trying to do it right now. So the task that I've set for myself, the thing I'm interested in doing, is one that might not be completed in my lifetime. And that is an absolutely valid, at least caution, if it's not an actual criticism.
Yeah. I know you have to go now. But one last thing here that I tend to ask people. You ponder these enormous questions. And thinking back, but not going in the direction of Boltzmann, I mean, what are you optimistic about?
Oh, I'm very optimistic. I think that we might... So I predicted a little while ago, someone asked, what is the biggest thing that we will do in your field over the next 50 years? I think we'll understand the Big Bang. I think that we'll really be able to agree on what happened 13.7 billion years ago that we now call the Big Bang. I'm not quite sure how it will happen, but 50 years is a very long time. But I think that we're at a stage now where we're beginning to talk intelligently about the possibilities for what happened at the Big Bang. I'm very optimistic that we're going to understand the other 96% of the universe that is not ordinary matter, the stuff that we call dark matter and dark energy. The next 10 years, I think, are going to be the dark matter decade. I think we're going to be detecting dark matter. We're going to be making it in the laboratory, really learning fascinating new things about that. I think the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva is going to tell us something that we don't know yet. It's going to surprise us by looking at a regime of the universe that we've never looked at before. And I think that, you know, physics is going to be have all these interdisciplinary implications for information theory, computer science, biology, network theory, complex systems. I want to understand not just why the entropy of the universe was low and got bigger, but why the complexity of the universe started very low, has gotten big today, and is going to get low again. The universe is going to decay away and not be complex. How does complexity feed off the growth of entropy and questions like that? So I think that, you know, I think that the 21st century is going to put the 20th century to shame in terms of thinking great thoughts about the universe.
All right. Well, let's report back another time and find out what's going on.
Sounds good to me.
Sean Carroll, thanks very much.
All right, great. Thanks, Roger.
Thank you.